And on the phone with us with a look at the backcountry, we've got Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. You know, the last time it snowed here in Utah was roughly about 10 days ago. So January 9th was the last significant snowfall that we had. And, you know, since then, we've had 64 avalanches reported to the Utah Avalanche Center throughout northern Utah, with 8 people being caught, carried, buried, and injured. These avalanches have been 2 to 6 feet deep and about 100 to 1,000 feet wide in some cases, running all the way down slopes into the flats. One of the more significant avalanches was actually down in the Provo Mountains. This thing was huge. It was 2 to 8 feet deep, and it was up to 1.5 miles wide, running 3,000 vertical feet down into the flat. So a massive avalanche down there in the Provo Mountains. So what this is all meaning is that over the past couple of days, we've seen avalanche activity slow down. The reason for that is as the snowpack kind of adjusts to its weight of the added snow, things begin to settle down and be quiet. But as you just heard from Devin, we do have a lot of snow coming in Friday into Saturday. And my guess is the avalanche activity will once again peak and possibly reach high danger by this weekend. So if you're going to head to one of the world-class ski resorts, that's a great choice. But if you're going to head out into the backcountry, you need to be prepared this weekend. As for today, you know, like I said, those avalanches have quieted down. There's a lot of really nice powder out there in the mountains, especially in the mid-elevation shady aspects. However, we're still recommending to people that we watch our slope angle, so we don't want to be on any terrain that's steeper than about 30 degrees. So we really want to watch those slope angles out there. So the overall danger today is moderate on all mid and upper elevation slopes that are facing the north half of the compass, meaning the west through east facing slopes. If you're on a sunny slope, which is the south facing side of the mountain, you're going to find a lot of crust and kind of funky snow all the way up to mountaintops, and we actually have a low danger on those aspects. So, yeah, again, just going into the weekend, make sure you visit our advisory page, utahavalanchecenter.org, and make sure you get those full forecasts before heading into the backcountry.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday and sat through two appeals of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission's approval for the Colby School development. On the phone with a look at that and more, I have County Council Member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
Now, the council did not come to a decision after hearing the appeals against the Colby School project. And legally, I know you can't say much. You did go long, about 4.5 hours. But can you tell us when you will make a decision?
Well, no, we can't do that because, of course, we don't know what the deliberations are going to look like. You know, we're trying to get to it as rapidly as possible, but our schedule is jammed up, so we're going to have to pick away at this as time permits. You know, you have to understand that, for example, the day before the hearing, we got somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 pages of new testimony from the appellants, which is perfectly fine. It's just that we need time to digest that information. And while I struggled desperately to get that done before yesterday's meeting, it was not reasonable to accomplish it all. And I think other council members had the same problem.
Sure. So do those deliberations happen behind closed doors then?
No, we can. First of all, it's a matter of appeal, and so these items have to be held in public. It doesn't mean that we can't have executive sessions in which we discuss them, but again, those will be public meetings.
Sure. And can you tell me? I mean, are the appeals basically the same? I know there's two separate ones, or do they raise separate issues?
Let me start off by saying I've been in land use for the vast majority of my life, and of course that means I spend a lot of time talking to attorneys. This is perhaps the most complicated and complex land use issue that I have ever encountered. So there are numerous issues, and we're just trying to distill it down to the pertinent ones.
I guess I ask that because I'm wondering, I mean, if you uphold the Planning Commission's decision for one, does that mean you have to uphold it for the other because it's the same thing? Or
Well, that's always a concern, right? We need to be prudent about setting precedent. But the facts of this case are the facts, and we just have to work through them. That's it's just going to be a long, hard grind.
Okay. A lot of citizen comment last night about the Oscarthorpe farm. Doug, what's your reaction to the continued public comment?
Well, we want to hear from the public. We've been hearing public input for quite some time. The biggest problem that we have right now is that, you know, as we stated over and over and over again, we don't negotiate in public for land deals. And and at this point, we're beginning to see the misinformation spin out of control. That's unfortunate, but it's part of the process, unfortunately. There continues to be... We had a speaker last night who said that we were going to develop 500 homes on that parcel. The reality is that it's zoned for 7. We had speakers last night who said that they didn't want to see an improved shoulder on Old Ranch Road because that would just increase the bikeability of the road, and you know that's creating problems for them as it is right now. It would also increase speed. Those are valid comments. If you put a shoulder on the road, people will drive faster. That's just a known fact. But we have to balance the needs of all of our constituents, not just those people who live next to the Oscarthorpe farm.
Yeah. So why is it that the county does want that bike path there along Old Ranch Road? And does it conflict with the federal funding?
The bike path on Old Ranch Road, we did one on the north-south section of Old Ranch Road, in which we put about a 3 or 4 foot shoulder on either side of the road. That's the one that we heard complaints about yesterday. What that 3 to 4 foot shoulder represents is simply an improvement of the road to what would be considered to be normal roadway standards. And I'm sorry, I blanked on the last part of your question.
Oh, just does that conflict with the federal funding at all?
Oh, well, there is an issue that if we take easements for the road, or if we take easements for the trails that we want around the perimeter of the property, that it would impair the amount of federal funding that they can get. Now, we're talking about numbers that are in the neighborhood of 3%, 4%, 5% of the total property. What we heard last night was that our request was going to depreciate the value of the federal easement by somewhere between 20% and a third. I don't view that as being accurate, but even if it were, we still have to get public benefit out of this process.
So how do you feel when the public suggests that the council wants to see development on this farmland? I think you made a comment after you heard from the public saying that the Oscarthorpes could easily put 500 to 600 units on their property.
I'm sorry. I made a comment after that public comment. Yes,
yes.
You're right. Yeah, the response was that, the property is zoned what it's zoned for. We don't have funds for purchasing farmland. We are, as the council, I think we are very, very resolute about preventing sprawl to the greatest extent that we practically can. It's in our general plan. But that doesn't mean that we can go out and buy up individual home sites with monies that are earmarked for recreation.
Citizens have talked about wildlife on the farm, although the Oscarthorpes, my understanding, did put up a fence recently to keep out the elk and the deer.
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's a, again, it's a complicated subject. You know, we had people talk about the use of the property by cranes, sandhill cranes. You know, I'm a birder from when I'm back in my teens, which is getting to be a little bit over 45 years or so. You know, I appreciate seeing sandhill cranes out there. But the Osgathorpes did put up an 8-foot fence to prevent elk or moose or deer or any other ungulates from crossing their property. So, you know, it comes down to the question of what is it we're preserving and are we getting public benefit from that? You know, we spend a lot of time spending huge amounts of money on trying to lower the kill rate on large animals on the highways, and trying to do everything we possibly can to preserve their habitat. You know, the 8-foot fence makes that not a reality.
Some other comments during public comment. One resident asked, what is the council doing about the growth and the traffic clogging the highways? So what is the council doing about that?
We're, you know, this is a this is one of our biggest challenges and certainly one that we accepted willingly. But the, you know, the notion that that there's something we can do to snap our fingers to relieve all these situations is not well-founded. These are very difficult and complex issues. They take tens of millions of dollars. We have to dramatically increase our expenses on transportation. We, of course, are doing that. You've seen the success of the e-bus, and we're, you know, I just looked at a e-bus that was brought to us the other day that can actually negotiate Parley's Canyon. So we're actively pursuing all feasible traffic mitigation that we can. But again, it's going to be a very slow process and take a lot of money. I think it was mentioned to us last night that there's $100 million worth of roadway and transit improvements in our budget in the future. And we will spend the monies that we've received and collected from taxes to reduce traffic, primarily through transit. We are not expanding roads. We're making it easier for the buses to do their job. But it comes down to the issue of the fact that, you know, as Pogo said, we've met the enemy and we are them. And it's the, you know, in part the daily traffic of the residents of the basin that are contributing to the problem, not just our guests.
Yeah, so some of the other items on the agenda talking about bonding for transit projects this year, some $20 million we'll see bonded for. And would the Eckery Hill remote lot then be one of those projects?
We're bonding right now. We have not said where those funds are going to be. The Eckery Hill lot is one of the items on our target list. That is also tied up in a negotiation with Vail, in which we're with TCFC, with the Canyons, in which we're attempting to get monies to help fund remote parking. But none of those deals are done yet.
All right. You also heard briefly from Sue Hamilton, the resident at the preserve, with the illegal maintenance facility operated by Fredco. She said despite the county's cease and desist order, the facility is still operating. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, it's simply a matter of it's simply a matter of law is what it boils down to. Not only our law, but normal procedures are that when you file an appeal, typically things are stayed. So Fredco, or not Fredco perhaps, but the preserve, filed an appeal to maintain Fredco's operation there. That will be heard by an administrative law judge. The appeal process is essentially out of our hands at this point. And the reason why we were not able to pursue it, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, was simply that our attorney who was working on this issue got the flu.
Okay. Doug, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think we're good, Leslie. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time. Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde, you're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by...
Well, as the clock clicks down to get a development agreement in place, the Park City Planning Commission got another look at that reduced density and revised plan for Treasure Hill. In the studio is the chairman of the Planning Commission, Adam Strawn. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what did we get out of last night's discussion?
I think we got out of it that... The city and the applicant are still pushing back and forth on each other, as they should, to try to figure out how this development is going to, how it's going to look.
Niels Vernegaard said that he thought some things were supposed to be decided at last night's meeting and the Sweeneys would get their $6 million check, but that hasn't happened then, huh?
Yeah, and it's a valid point. I mean, I think everybody on all sides of this has been looking to a resolution, and there have been some representations made that, you know, we'll have a decision on this date or we'll have a decision by this date. And, you know, it's hard because it's a push and pull. You don't want to, as the city and as the Planning Commission, just roll over and say, this is so much better than the prior Sweeney proposal that we'll just do anything to get it approved and we'll just rush the process. You want to make sure that it's done right. It's still a large project, so there's a lot of analysis that has to be done on it. If this came in clean and it didn't have any of the background that the Sweeney's proposal brought, we would be looking at this hard and it would take this long. So... you know, I understand that frustration. I share it, but at the same time, I don't want this to be a cram down.
Staff has proposed two different maps for the new private road. The applicant has its own map. So what have we decided? I mean, we've got, basically it's an issue of grade, huh?
It is, and it's an engineering dispute, and the applicant's engineers are reviewing some of the data, and the city's engineers are reviewing some of the data, and they just need to square up, and I think once they do, then a whole bunch of other pieces will fall into place, but this road and its positioning is one of the major holdups.
Right. And what we're seeing from the city, several turns, lots more turns with a less steep road. And then the applicants is basically just like a big S. So not a lot of turns. Does that just make it that much steeper? Is that what that means?
I don't know exactly from an engineering point of view what that means. But, you know, once we have the engineers review this and we get back some drawings with the grading, you know, topographical maps and so forth, we're going to be able to know how steep those roads are going to be and where. So, again, we're still, you know, waiting on that information.
Yeah, because ideally, I mean, the applicant's map would be road would be better because there's a lot less turns and cuts and all of that.
It might be.
A lot less road surface, right?
It might be.
Yeah. Assistant City Manager Matt Dias talked about there being two obligations with regard to affordable housing. What are those?
Well, I think there's not two obligations with regard to affordable housing. There's two different ideas about how to satisfy the affordable housing obligation. One idea is that the unit should be on site, and one idea is that the unit should be off site. There are nuances to that. That simplifies it, but that is the gist of it. And at some level, that's a policy decision that the housing authority, aka the city council, is going to have to make. I mean, the Planning Commission can provide input, but I think the city council is probably going to be the final arbiter on that one.
How many units are we talking about? Because I had heard a figure of between 8,000 and 12,000 square feet needed.
I think that's about right. I don't know whether the units on those, I can't remember off the top of my head how many units that is. It was presented to us last night. Anne Laurent walked us through that, but I just can't remember them. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And again, if we're trying to reduce density on, from the hill, it doesn't make a lot of sense to build more, or does it?
Well, you know, it's a valid question, and counterbalancing that is, well, do we want to have our employees live not where they work and driving or commuting somehow or not? And, you know, I think those are policy decisions that are, you know, better answered by elected officials.
What about the phasing of construction? I think that a little back and forth on that. Does the applicant build the single-family homes first and then the hotel, or I think the applicant is preferring to build the hotel first and then the homes?
I think that's undecided. You know, the phasing on it would come at a later date. I mean, we're still looking, A, at the road, and then, B, next meeting we're going to be looking at the massing of this thing, and so end of the single-family homes. But, you know, that a lot of that may be driven by the finances behind it and whether the ultimate developer of this can finance building either the single-family homes first or the hotel first.
So have we defined boutique hotel yet? That came up again at last night's meeting. And does it even matter that we define it?
I don't think it matters. It, you know, what matters is the square footage. It always has been about the square footage. You can call a duck a horse, but if the duck is 60,000 square feet, you know it's not a duck. So, poor analogy, but I just don't care what it's called. I just want to know how big it is and what the impacts are going to be.
And is it just hotel rooms and maybe a restaurant, or is there convention space? And do we know?
You know, there's going to be meeting space, and that's one of the issues we're talking about. I don't know that convention space would be a good idea, and I don't even think that's in the cards. I think the meeting space is going to have to be defined according to the use, and, you know, that use definition is going to have to be carefully looked at because we do not want, large, let's say, Youth Winter Sports Alliance style fundraisers happening up there where hundreds and hundreds of people come and try to park. That may be too impactful on the neighborhood, so we need to define that meeting space and what its uses are.
And do we have square footages at this point, or we don't know that either?
Well, we have the broad square footages that were presented last night in the form of a table, and it looks like it's going to be somewhere around 383,000 square feet, give or take a little. So we know that, and from there, I think it's just a matter of kind of getting to the specifics, and then we'll arrive at that final number.
I see. So it's really, so if it's that big, it's they need to decide how many hotel rooms and how much meeting space.
Yeah.
That's their call. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. During the parking portion of the discussion, staff shared that the negotiations also looking at a 20% reduction in the transportation plan. They weren't real clear about, is that just employee parking or guest? I mean, what are we looking at?
I think it's 20% reduction in the parking, not the transportation plan. And there's actually three alternatives. One is to fully park it according to code. Second is to reduce that codified parking allotment by 20%. And the third is to reduce that parking allotment by 35%. And the counterbalance to that would be an incentive to for the developer to build up the midstation in a certain fashion. Unclear which is going to be the best for this project, but I think what is clear is that the amount of parking that should be put on the project should not be put in the mid-station area. It should be in the hotel and in the single-family homes. Nobody wants to have a second parking lot where skiers can drive up, park, and get on the lift, or mountain bikers can park and get on the lift. That's not the intent here.
Yeah, I guess just the short conversation that we've had, I mean, it sounds like there's still so much to be decided. And we're talking about having this done by next week. Is that possible?
Well, I don't think we're going to have this done by next week. There are a couple factors at play here. One of the biggest is that the Sweeneys and Park City 2 LLC have their own internal deadline, which appears to be the end of January, which is why the applicant last night asked us to hold meetings on the 24th and again on January 30th. Staff believes they can get there, and the applicant believes that too. I haven't been privy to those negotiations, so I don't know whether that's realistic, but I don't think they would tell me and the other commissioners that they thought it was realistic if it wasn't. They wouldn't plant that idea. It's just too dangerous. So I realize from the 30,000-foot level, it looks like there's a long way to go, but I think that's just because all of these specifics haven't come out yet, and when they do, I think we'll see how far along the project really is.
Yeah. So is our staff working on anything else, or is this it? This is what city government is doing.
Well, you got a lot of departments and a lot of people, and, you know, I think that might be oversimplifying things, but they are working very, very hard, and as well they should. I mean, this is a huge project in the middle of Old Town, something that's concerned this community for 35 years, maybe more. Do we not want them to devote Herculean efforts to this? I mean, I think they should.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention from the meeting?
Nothing.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. Adam Strawn is the chairman of the Park City Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:44. It's 8:49. Good morning. Well, the Sundance Film Festival, not just about films. Off-screen is the section that can round out the 10 days with a cultural outlet outside the theater. In the studio, I have the curator of the panels program, John Nine. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leslie.
So talk a little bit about what happens then in this off-screen section.
You know, it's our chance to basically capitalize on all these amazing people being here in Park City for the festival. You have subjects of documentaries, you have the filmmakers themselves, you have cast, you have all these people who are bringing in, exhibits for the new Frontiers section. They're all here, and you sort of want to hear them talk about the work that they're doing. So we have a number of different venues, a number of different strands of programs, always looking for the issues and ideas that are in the film and giving the audience a chance to sort of engage with the filmmakers in a way more than you would just with a Q&A. And but then, you know, we have, I think maybe what I'm most excited about, we've been working on our Cinema Cafe strand for a few years now. And it really, you know, this year I think we look at this program and it's exactly what we've always wanted it to be. It's this really eclectic, casual conversation series in which we pair people in ways that are kind of unexpected. You're not quite sure what to make of it. And then as you go through this conversation, it makes sense. So, you know, we kick that off tomorrow, for example, with Will.i.am, a musician, songwriter, DJ, producer, filmmaker, and in this case, technologist. He has a VR exhibit called Masters of the Sun based on his Marvel graphic novel. So we're pairing him with the comic book nerd extraordinaire Kevin Smith. I think that's going to be an interesting conversation. If you look through the Cinema Cafe program for the rest of the week, you'll see names like Ira Glass, Miranda July, Ethan Hawke, and maybe the biggest star I think we've ever had in our program on Sunday. You know, we've had senators, Nobel laureates, movie stars, rock stars, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on our Sunday Cinema Cafe. I don't think I've ever had an event that more people have asked me about than Justice Ginsburg. So it should be in conversation with NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Oh, wow. So these are open to festival credential holders.
Open to credential holders, and most of them happening at the Filmmaker Lodge. That Cinema Cafe series is our morning series. Normally it's at 11:30 every day. There are a few slight variations to that, all of which will be on our website. But yeah, mainly the late morning.
Right. Are they live streamed? So because it's
some
only
of them are,
people.
Yeah, some of them are live streamed. You just have to check the listing. Some of them are live streamed and you can see them either on our YouTube channel, Sundance's YouTube channel, or some of them are actually in partnership with the New York Times, and there'll be Times Talks, which means they stream on the New York Times' Times Talk stream.
All right. So what about the Ruth Justice?
Yep, that'll be on Sundance's. Sundance's YouTube channel, 11:30 on Sunday.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the other section. You've got Power of Story, one of the two this year titled Culture Shift. What's that about?
Yeah, you know, so Power of Story really is the way that we sort of take the larger themes of the year in art and culture and try to put together some conversations that you have to do with artists' role in that. And I think, you know, that first one, Culture Shift, this is almost something that we talk about. It's not a new topic. We talk about this year after year after year, but, you know, maybe the implications are slightly different from year to year. This is a really exciting group of people sort of talking about the way in which artists can move the needle on culture. And in addition to, you know, some really interesting artists like Issa Rae, Patrick Gaspard, who is the new head of the Open Societies Foundation, who used to be a ambassador to South Africa, really, really interested in this idea of cultural diplomacy. So we're trying to put ideas together in a way that maybe are not as expected. And then our second Power of Story panel next Friday, a week from tomorrow, is some of the filmmakers whose careers really started in the indie world, but now you find them directing huge franchises, like, for example, Taika Waititi, who just directed the Thor movie, who, you know, I think we have played every single film Taika's ever made, Catherine Hardwicke, who directed the first Twilight film, Justin Lin, who directed some of the Fast and Furious movies, Star Trek. So, you know, these are people who we consider Sundance directors who all of a sudden are behind films that have, you know, $100 million budgets, and we're sort of interested in how they approach that from a creative standpoint. So that's our second one. And then, of course, we have afternoon panels at the Lodge. And I want to point out especially the strand that we've always had, but in its new location, the New Frontier panels. New Frontier has a new home this year, as maybe people know, in the basement of what used to be the Sports Authority, which is now our Ray venue. That basement is the New Frontier section, and we have an area called The Box, and the New Frontier panels are stunning, really, really amazing. They'll blow your mind. Some conversations about creating VR worlds, some of the artists whose work is in the program, so you can also check those out on our website.
Right. So back to like the Power of Story. I mean, these are ticketed events, not easy to get. And again, small theater at the Egyptian. Again, are those live streamed? People can find this just by going online?
Yeah. So a couple of the second one will be live streamed and the first one won't be live, but we'll put it up shortly afterwards. So people will have a chance to watch it for sure. I do encourage people to, you know, if you're really interested and you want to be there live in person. The wait list usually gets in. I mean, you know, depends. You don't want to be the 150th person on the wait list. But, we see the wait list coming in every time for those panels. So I think not beyond reason that you could get in.
Okay. In the program, though, it just seemed like there were pages and pages of panels. But you had mentioned maybe you just were producing or publishing the ones that are hosted,
yeah.
These are by sponsors.
You know, I do think there's probably an uptick in panels. I'm not sure what it is. I've been doing this for a long time, and for me, the value of conversation and dialogue around the films has always been there. But you know, I think you're seeing a lot more interest in putting together panels around the program, and so we do. We have a lot of sponsors of the festival. Some of them have spaces here on Main Street or elsewhere, and you'll find some really fascinating programs in their spaces as well. Dialogues, conversations, and those are all listed also in our marketing materials and online under hosted presentations.
Right. One that caught my eye are the docs on PBS distribution.
Yeah. There's a real range, you know, everything from industry-oriented panels to, craft, you know, people talking about editing. So it's a real range. You know, I think you know, anybody who's looking for something to do and didn't get into a movie in the morning or afternoon, there's going to be an interesting conversation for you somewhere.
Yeah, it looks like you've also taken up the shop as a new venue.
The shop has multi-purposes, and we've had it for a number of years, but I suppose it's a little bit more versatile this year. There are some interesting things happening there, including some panels as well.
Yeah, I wanted to also ask you about just another job I think that you've taken on. You head up the Sundance Collection at UCLA. This is an archive. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the archive, this is a program that's existed for, I want to say, 17 years. And the idea behind it is very simple. We have so many films that are core to the tradition that we have at Sundance, to the history of independent film. And those are films that, you know, unless someone actively tries to conserve or preserve or restore these films, you know, many of them are actually in real jeopardy. And so this is a program that we partnered with the UCLA Film and Television Archive, which is one of the biggest archives in the world. And we are out there actively trying to restore works that we consider to be, you know, core to independent film. We sometimes often play them at the festival. We're going to be doing an evening with Todd Haynes on Saturday at 8:30 in the Egyptian, and that's going to feature some of his early work, some of which we've restored with UCLA. We do it every year, and you know, I think what you're really seeing is the ability for these old films to come back into currency somehow, and to, you know, sort of put us back into touch with both the history of independent film, but also the ideas, the issues. You know, you oftentimes you watch a film and you think, wow, this has never been more relevant than, you know, than it is today. So we're really proud of putting our resources into saving these films. That's what it comes down to. You know, if we don't actively participate in that, then some of them will disappear. The end.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, and you know, take a risk. Go out and enjoy some part of the festival that's not just a film. You know, I think there's some amazing people here, so we hope that you'll partake.
Okay, John, thanks for your time this morning.
Leslie.
John Nyhan again with the Sundance Film Festival, one of the senior programmers, also the curator of the off-screen program.